From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I think the proposition is unfair. We are human beings. We have to be treated with dignity. That's all we want, dignity.
Between 500,000 and 1,000,000 people filled the streets of Los Angeles this weekend to protest a proposed new anti-immigrant bill. The Senate begins debate on immigration reform today. Then the controversy over presidential power. When President Bush signed a law banning torture, he quietly signed a statement saying he could bypass it. Now he signed the USA Patriot Act, but also signed a statement that says he doesn't consider oversight binding. And we'll look at the latest on Sudan. As a student-led divestment campaign gains momentum in the United States, the Sudanese government takes out an 8-page ad in the New York Times.
The New York Times has just taken nearly $1 million in advertising revenue from a government guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity. That does seem very questionable.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Los Angeles, between 500,000 and 1,000,000 people filled the streets Saturday to protest the new anti-immigration bill, H.R. 4457. The Los Angeles Times reports it was possibly the largest gathering in the city's history. One local Spanish-language TV station in Los Angeles put the crowd total at over 2 million people. Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa address the crowd in Spanish.
De la reforma migratoria, pero no en criminalizar a nuestros hijos.
Villaraigosa, who's the city's first Latino mayor, said we're in favor of an immigration reform, but not in criminalizing our children. The House of Representatives has already approved legislation that would criminalize 11 million undocumented immigrants and make it a crime for priests, nuns, health care workers, and other social workers to offer them help. Other large immigrant-led protests occurred throughout the country. 50,000 people took to the streets of Denver. 20,000 rallied in Phoenix in what may have been the city's largest protest ever. In Atlanta, 70,000 immigrant workers took part in a work stoppage on Friday. Other protests occurred in New York, Charlotte, Dallas, Sacramento. In Washington, the Senate Judiciary Committee is expected to begin debating the Senate version of the immigration bill today. In Iraq, at least 40 people have died after a suicide bomber attacked a U.S. and Iraqi military base near the cities of Mosul and Tal Afar. U.S. officials said the bomb exploded in an Iraqi police recruiting center at the base and that no Americans were killed. The attack comes just days after President Bush cited Tal Afar as an example of a successful city in Iraq. He described it as a, quote, free city that gives reason for hope for a free Iraq. Meanwhile, conflicting reports are coming out of Baghdad over a U.S.-backed raid that killed about 17 supporters of the Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Iraqi police say U.S. troops raided a Shiite mosque. One eyewitness described the attack like this.
American and Iraqi forces came after prayers with some other people and opened fire. Local residents came to the mosque when they saw what was happening. Around 17 people were dead.
The dead included the mosque's 80-year-old imam. The U.S. military has said none of its troops entered the mosque, but admitted U.S. Special Forces were at the scene advising Iraqi troops. Earlier in the day, a mortar shell nearly hit Muqtada al-Sadr's home in the southern holy city of Najaf. Meanwhile, officials in Bakuba are investigating the beheading of 30 men. Their bodies were discovered on Sunday. In the Kurdish area of Iraq, a court has sentenced a writer to 18 months in prison for publicly criticizing the Kurdish leader, Masoud Barzani. The Iraqi-born writer, Kamal Karim Kadir, was arrested last fall and charged with threatening the national security of Kurdistan. Here in this country, in Hurricane Katrina news, FEMA has broken a promise to reopen four multi-million-dollar no-bid contracts awarded to politically connected companies. Shortly after the hurricane hit, FEMA gave major no-bid contracts to Bechtel, Shaw Group, Fluor, and the company CH2M Hill. FEMA vowed to rebid the contracts after legislators criticized the no-bid contracts because two of the companies had close political ties to the White House. The Shaw Group's lobbyist, Joe Albaugh, He is the former director of FEMA and a personal friend of President Bush. The CEO of Bechtel, Riley. Bechtel previously served on Bush's Export Council. Meanwhile, it's been revealed that when First Lady Barbara Bush donated money for Hurricane Katrina evacuees in Houston, her donation came with specific instructions. Part of it had to be spent on buying educational software from her son Neil Bush's company, Ignite Learning. Former President Bush's chief of staff, Gene Becker, defended the donation, saying, quote, Mrs. Bush wanted to do something specifically for education and specifically for the thousands of students flooding into the Houston schools. A week after Katrina hit, Barbara Bush was criticized after she told the radio show Marketplace that the relocation to Houston was, quote, working very well for some of those forced out of New Orleans since they were already underprivileged. And in New Orleans, residents are rallying for the city to reopen Charity Hospital, the city's only level one trauma center. The public hospital has been closed since Hurricane Katrina caused massive flooding that ruined the hospital's electrical system. On Saturday, about 100 doctors, former patients, and other residents held a rally outside the hospital. Questions are now being raised as to whether Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia should recuse himself from an upcoming case about the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay. Newsweek's reporting, Scalia recently gave a speech in Switzerland where he dismissed the idea that detainees have rights under the U.S. Constitution or international conventions. During the speech, Scalia said he was, quote, astounded at the hypocritical reaction in Europe to Guantanamo. Scalia said, quote, war is war, and it has never been the case that when you captured a combatant, you have to give them a jury trial in your civil courts, he said. On Tuesday, the Supreme Court scheduled to hear arguments in a case that'll decide whether the Bush administration can try Guantanamo prisoners in special military tribunals. 2 years ago, Scalia recused himself from a case about the Pledge of Allegiance after he made public comments about the issue. In Argentina, thousands gathered this weekend to condemn the 30th anniversary of the U.S.-backed coup that resulted in the deaths and disappearances of tens of thousands. This is Marta Vasquez of the Mothers of the Plaza de Mayo.
Las madres estamos aquí con ustedes.
The mothers are here with you, the people, and we will continue to be with you in this fight until we know what happened to each and every one of our children. What was their final destiny? Who gave the order? Who executed it? Because it's the least we could demand to know.
Meanwhile, newly declassified documents reveal that then-Secretary of State Henry Kissinger ordered immediate U.S. support for the military junta shortly after it seized power. According to the minutes of one meeting, Kissinger said, quote, I do want to encourage them. I don't want to give the sense that they're harassed by the United States. Kissinger said this even though his own top deputy in Latin America was predicting Argentina would face, quote, a fair amount of repression and probably a good deal of blood under the new regime. In addition, State Department cables show U.S. officials had prior knowledge of coup plotting. More than a week before the coup, the commander of the Argentine Navy requested the U.S. Embassy recommend public relations firms inside the United States, which would work for the future military junta. In news from Africa, calls are increasing for Nigeria to detain and arrest former Liberian President Charles Taylor, who's been indicted for war crimes. On Saturday, Nigeria's President Obasanjo said he would allow Liberia to take custody of Taylor, but no details were released on how or when this would happen. The Liberian government said Sunday Taylor could be sent directly to the UN-backed War Crimes Tribunal in Sierra Leone. Taylor has lived in Nigeria since 2003 when he stepped down as Liberia's president. Obasanjo is traveling to Washington Tuesday and is expected to meet with President Bush. Here in this country, in South Dakota, a petition drive has been launched to overturn the state's new ban on abortion. The South Dakota Campaign for Healthy Families is aiming to collect enough signatures to bring the abortion question to a statewide referendum in November. South Dakota's governor recently signed legislation making the state the first to ban women from receiving abortions except in cases where it'll save a woman's life. Under the law, doctors will face up to 5 years in prison and a $5,000 fine for performing an illegal abortion. Former Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff is expected to soon be subpoenaed to answer questions about the mob-style killing of Gus Bulas in 2001. Months before the killing, Abramoff and a partner bought the Sun Cruise casinos from Bulas. Abramoff has never been charged in the killing, but a lawyer for one of the men accused of the crime wants to question Abramoff in court. In France, students and union activists are preparing for a national strike Tuesday to protest the new national law that makes it easier for employers to fire young workers. And in labor news, farm workers from the Coalition of Immokalee Workers have launched a 17-city tour to call on the fast food restaurant McDonald's to give tomato pickers better wages and improve working conditions. The tour comes just a year after the Immokalee workers led a successful boycott of Taco Bell. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets of downtown Los Angeles to demonstrate against a new anti-immigrant bill being considered by Congress. Stretching for 26 blocks, the crowd of what's believed to be between 500,000 and 2 million people marched peacefully in what was possibly the largest gathering in Los Angeles history. Some estimates put the crowd around 1 million, others 2 million, others 500,000. The rally was organized by numerous unions, religious organizations, and immigrant rights groups and publicized through Spanish language media. Many of the demonstrators wore white to symbolize peace and chanted, "Si se puede," yes, we can. Here are two demonstrators speaking Saturday.
I think the proposition is unfair. We are human beings. We have to be treated with dignity. That's all we want, dignity.
Our children are fighting for this country in Iraq. Why discriminate? It's not fair. Say no to 4437. No.
At a mass rally, Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa addressed the crowd in Spanish.
Estamos en favor de la reforma migratoria, pero no en criminalizar a nuestros hijos.
Villaraigosa is Los Angeles' first Latino mayor. He went on to say, "We are in favor of an immigration reform, but not in criminalizing our children." The House of Representatives approved legislation in December that would criminalize 11 million undocumented immigrants and make it a crime for priests, nuns, healthcare workers, and other social workers to offer them help. Several cities, including Los Angeles, have passed resolutions against the House legislation, and some, such as Maywood, have declared itself a sanctuary for undocumented immigrants. The Senate is considering similar legislation today. Demonstrations are planned near the Capitol, including a prayer service with immigration advocates and clergy who plan to wear handcuffs to demonstrate the criminalization of immigrants. The Roman Catholic Church and other religious communities have launched immigrant rights campaigns in recent weeks. Hundreds of thousands of people staged demonstrations in more than a dozen cities. 50,000 people took to the streets of Denver, 20,000 in Phoenix, and what may have been Phoenix's largest protest ever. In Atlanta, an estimated 70,000 immigrant workers took part in a work stoppage Friday. We go now to Los Angeles to speak with longtime immigrant rights activist Javier Rodriguez, spokesperson for the March 25th Coalition Against 4437, the umbrella group that organized Saturday's march. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Javier.
Thank you, Amy. It is wonderful to see you after this Saturday, let me tell you.
Can you talk about what happened on Saturday, why so many people took to the streets?
People, since around the early January, were waiting for the call to convene massively here in Los Angeles, and what happened was not necessarily beyond our expectations, and I am speaking about us, the organizers in this major coalition in Los Angeles. We were looking at the process, and let me say that this was a three-week process, organizing process, and we saw the indicators, Amy, and the indicators definitely told us that it was going to be big. How big, that was the only guessing point. We knew we were going to have 1 million. After that, We didn't know how much.
How many do you estimate now came out this weekend?
We estimate anywhere between a million and a million and a half. Yes.
Javier, what are you demanding? What are your major objections to the legislation? The House passed it. The Senate's considering it. And what are you demanding in its place?
This is the same, basically the same demand as back in 1984, in the 80s, when we were able to successfully get the Simpson-Rodino bill into law, which gave amnesty to approximately 3.5-4 million undocumented workers. And the battle cry then was amnesty, legalization, protection for all the undocumented. And we were able to get that. Now, in this case, the conditions have changed, and they are 12 million. And they meaning all those immigrants without the so-called legalization, the so-called protection, so that they can say, I am somebody. They are us. They are the American people already. They are interwoven into society, but of course they are the most exploited. So the main demand is legalization for the 12 million undocumented. And that was the message of hope that was sent out on the call approximately 3 weeks ago on March the 8th.
Javier, we're also joined on the phone by Dolores Huerta, pioneering civil rights activist, co-founder of the United Farm Workers of America. Can you talk about the significance of these protests? Having been involved in many, this clearly is one of the largest California has seen.
Well, Amy, I want to say that the people who deserve an awful lot of credit for the great turnout, as in Chicago and also in Los Angeles, where all of the media, the Spanish-speaking media, just took on this cause. They coordinated it. They made sure that people knew that the demonstration was going to be happening. They did sometimes four-hour-long programs so people would call in and get information. And it really shows you the power of media, especially progressive media like yourself and what the Latino radio stations did, El Cucuy, El Piolín, and all of these great radio broadcasters to bring people together. But I believe that it is having some impact. We know we still have a long way to go. Specter bill, and of course Senator Frist has come out and said that he's going to be, for walls across the border and as much punitive measures as can be enacted. But the other bills are really punitive because they call for anywhere from 1 to 20 years of prison for anybody who has been deported and comes back into the country. The so-called guest worker visas that they are talking about issuing also include a waiver of any rights that one has in the United States, which, of course, undocumented in this country, although they don't get welfare benefits or anything like that, but they do have some protections in terms of unpaid wages, et cetera. So those bills are very, very punitive. We are supporting the McCain-Kennedy bill, although there are some provisions in that also that, you know, need to be cleaned up. Now, because the McCain-Kennedy bill does have provisions that will allow for a legalization procedure in that legislation. So these demonstrations are having an impact right now. We see a little bit of wavering, not enough in the Republican Party. We've definitely got to go on. And the labor unions and the religious groups, the student groups and community groups that came together for this fantastic march that was held here, the largest march, as you said, in L.A. history. They are going to be continuing to meet so that we can then go on further and take further actions because we really can't stop until we stop this really onerous legislation that is now being considered.
Dolores Huerta, let me go back to Javier Rodriguez. What do you think of President Bush's guest worker program proposal?
I mean, let me say the following. The guest worker program, the unofficial guest worker program, has been in effect since 1986. It is workers coming in without the regularization. What the president wants, as well as President Mexico, is to regularize the workers, but again, without any rights whatsoever. Can I Can I refer back to the mobilization, Amy? The mobilization was essentially hatched with a strategy. And that strategy included essentially two things. One, the organizing of the network of the infrastructure in the state of California. And we began to develop that, to put that in place. Secondly, it consisted of a political and media strategy. The political was to send the message of hope and, of course, to stand to stop the Sensenbrenner bill because of its horrendous and macabre clauses, fascist clauses. And the other, it was the media strategy. We knew the cultural psychology of our people. We knew the cultural psychology of the media. And we went after the strong, large media that exists in the LA County area. And we went after not only the disc jockeys in the area, which some of them, a couple of them at least, and one of them in particular has the number one spot, and he's had it for a couple of years in this area, and this is the Spanish language media in competition with the English speaking disc jockeys. Now, we went after them, but as I said, also television, also the print media, and we sent a message to them through our first press conference that it was with them. We appealed to them that. And it was, the message was accepted little by little, gradually, but on the second week, they came in full speed ahead. Disc jockeys, we were able to organize a press conference in which approximately 15 of them participated, and then from that moment on, it was magic. The rest of the media, and then the rest of the community, the rest of the organizations, it began to galvanize. And as I said, the indicators were definitely there. The buses began to exhaust from the rental agencies. The people in the communities, the organizations began to call the disc jockeys, began to be interviewed sporadically by the Spanish language media, and other, many, many other indicators, many anecdotes that began to tell us, yes, we were going to have a successful march. But the objective of the march, the main objective, was to integrate, inject the undocumented community, the immigrant community, and the immigrant rights organizations, the community organizations, labor, and other folks, other sectors, especially the students also, which definitely mobilized into the national debate in order to pressure Congress with the amount of people rising. And
do you have a sense in the Senate right now that they have heard your call today?
Well, the let's say again, some of the indicators in the language that is being projected now, including President Bush. Yes, it is. It has begun to shift a little now.
I was in Charlottesville, Virginia this weekend, and I was talking to a woman who said her friend, who is a minister, who works with undocumented workers, is terrified because under the new law, she feared that she could be put in jail for working with people who don't have the papers they're supposed to have.
You know, let me say the senator, your senator, Hillary Clinton, mentioned something that was poignant, and that is that Sensenbrenner and the Republicans, if this law passes, they're going to arrest Jesus. Well, in our case, we're going to, not that we're going to, we think the parallel is the following. If this bill passes, if this bill becomes law, any of those clauses become law in the conciliation period, They're going to arrest La Virgen de Guadalupe, the Virgin of Guadalupe.
Well, Javier Rodriguez, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you for being with us, spokesperson for the March 25th Coalition, speaking to us from Los Angeles, and Dolores Huerta, pioneering civil rights leader, co-founder of the United Farm Workers of America. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Justicia tendrán, justicia verán, el mundo y los discriminados, recompensa ellos tendrán, no serán, no serán perjudicados.
Eddie Palmieri, Giudizia, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The three recently freed kidnapped members of the Christian Peacemaker teams have returned home. Last week, Norman Kember of Britain and Canadians James Loney and Harmeet Singh Sudan were found after nearly 4 months in captivity. It was only after their release that the men learned that their colleague, Tom Fox, had been killed 2 weeks earlier. On Saturday, Norman Kember addressed the media shortly after he flew home to London.
Now, there's a real sense in which you're are interviewing the wrong person. It's the ordinary people of Iraq that you should be talking to. Those are the people who have suffered so much over so many years and still await the stable and just society that they deserve. Another group that I hope you do not forget are the relatives of British soldiers killed or wounded in Iraq. Now, I do not believe that lasting peace is achieved through armed force, but I pay tribute to their courage and thank those who played a part in my release. I'm not ready at this time to talk about my months of captivity, except to say, of course, that I'm delighted to be free and reunited with my family. In reality, it was my wife who was kidnapped last November. She suffered more than I because while I knew that I was alive and well, she did not. And I thank all who supported Pat during that most agonizing and stressful time. Now, while in Baghdad, we had Canadians and I had the opportunity to thank the embassy staff who worked so diligently for our release. And I now thank the staff in Britain who also dedicated so much time to the same end. Then I'm grateful to all those from many faith communities who appealed for my release, held prayers and vigils in my name. Pat assures me that I will be overwhelmed by the volume of goodwill messages, and our home is currently like a flower shop. Mm-hmm. I thank the media for agreeing to share news and reduce the stress on me on this occasion. I now need to reflect on my experience. Was I foolhardy or rational? And also to enjoy freedom in peace and in quiet.
Norman Kember recently released one of the three members of the Christian Peacemaker teams that made it out alive from Iraq. Their colleague, Tom Fox, was killed. Norman Kember was speaking when he arrived in London. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Here in this country, the USA Patriot Act was reauthorized this month after a lengthy bipartisan effort to include new provisions safeguarding congressional oversight. The new provisions mandated President Bush to brief Congress about how the FBI is using expanded authorities to search and monitor people. But shortly after Bush signed the bill into effect, he quietly issued what is known as a signing statement, in which he lays out his interpretation of the law. In this document, Bush declared he did not consider himself bound by the oversight provisions. Bush wrote he could withhold the information if he decided that disclosing it would harm foreign relations, national security, or his duties as president. This wasn't the first time that such a statement came from the White House. When Congress passed a bill outlawing torture of detainees last year, President Bush quietly released a signing statement in which he affirmed his right to bypass the law if he felt it jeopardized national security. Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont said the president's latest efforts represent nothing short of a radical effort to manipulate the constitutional separation of powers and evade accountability and responsibility for following the law. We're joined right now in our Washington, D.C. studio by Charlie Savage, a reporter with the Boston Globe and the Washington Bureau. He's written a number of pieces exposing these signing statements that don't see the light of day very much. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Charlie Savage.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
It's good to have you with us. Well, just explain how these statements work. The president signs the law, and then someone hands him the statement?
Essentially, someone in his office, a lawyer, drafts a statement that gets issued along with the signing of the bill. This is not a proclamation that says, I'm really glad that I signed this bill, it's going to help us. It's a technically legal document that lays out how he's going to enforce the bill, what it is he says that he signed that day. And previous presidents have issued these, but they've never issued them the way President Bush has, both in terms of frequency and in terms of the aggression with which he says, I am not bound by this, I'm not bound by that, I will take this law in bits and pieces, I'll enforce the measures I like, and I have the power as president and commander-in-chief to ignore the provisions I don't like. And so in this case, in the Patriot Act case, all the provisions in which Congress said, we'll give you these powers, we'll renew this act, but you've got to tell us how you're using them so we make sure that they're not being abused. He said, as president and commander-in-chief and the head of the executive branch, I will decide what I tell you, if anything, and that's just what I can do under the Constitution.
How often have signing statements been used?
Well, as I said, previous presidents have done this going way back in time. The frequency really increased under the Reagan administration, and Clinton also issued a number of them. But President Bush has taken this to an unprecedented level. I think one study showed that through the end of 2004, there were more than 500 provisions of new laws that he had said that he would not consider himself bound to obey just through the end of his first term. And so He's really been aggressive about this in a new way.
How much attention have these signing statements gotten? The most recent one, the USA Patriot Act, which at first, well, there was a question, there's a lot of controversy about it. Explain how that happened, the more recent one, then we'll go back to torture.
How the signing statement happened or how we...
Yeah, how much attention it has gotten and what it means for senators who said that they weren't going to sign off on this unless they got certain concessions, and then this eviscerating, the signing statement eviscerating these concessions.
I understand. Well, initially, very little attention. No one is used to paying attention to these things. These are not something that's been regularly a part of the political fabric of our country. The traditional way that it happens is if a president gets a bill that he doesn't like, he either swallows the provisions he doesn't like and signs the whole thing, or he vetoes it because he says, I can't live with this, and then Congress can try to override the veto or not, depending on the strength. That's how traditionally it's supposed to work under the Constitution. And the Bush team has never vetoed a single bill in the 5 years he's been president now. Instead, they've used these signing statements to say that we will take the bits that we want and ignore the other parts. And just no one has been used to looking at these things. So Bush issued this signing statement on the Patriot Act on March 9th, the same day that he signed the bill. But it went almost unnoticed. There were a few legal specialist blogs that sort of took note of it in a wry way. I wrote this article that came out in Friday's paper, and there was a huge response as people realized what he had done again. But that was the first time in the mainstream media, at least, that it got received any kind of attention.
Now, the previous signing statement happened over New Year's. Can you talk about that around torture, specifically what the bill says, what the ban on torture is about, what's called the McCain bill, and then what the signing statement says?
Absolutely. Well, you may recall that there was a huge controversy in Congress last year with John McCain trying to make clear in federal law that it is illegal to torture, for a U.S. official to torture a detainee in U.S. custody, no matter where that detainee is, anywhere in the world. I think most specialists would say that was already illegal, but the Bush administration had come up with some contorted arguments about why maybe they could get around it if it was outside the U.S. border. And so there was a long fight in Congress in which McCain was trying to get this passed, and Bush threatened to veto it and fought it hard. Dick Cheney personally came to Congress to say, don't do this, don't do this. But Republicans came together with Democrats. They passed this overwhelmingly in both chambers. It was such a show of force in both chambers that Bush could not veto it. They had the strength to override the veto. So then he signed the bill. He invited McCain into the White House and said, oh, this is a good thing. It's going to help us with our image, even though he'd been fighting it all along. And then after McCain had left and everyone had gone home, he again issued one of these signing statements. This was on the Friday late in the evening, the weekend of New Year's Eve, when everyone had gone home, essentially, saying, by the way, I'm Commander-in-Chief, and I don't really have to pay attention to this. If I don't want to, if it's the national security's involved, I can do whatever I want. And again, you know, it was New Year's weekend, no one really paid attention. And I saw on a legal blog when I came into work the next week that someone was taking note of this and started exploring it. And sure enough, that's what he had said, and that's what it meant. I called the White House and asked them for an explanation, and they put me on the phone with someone to serve as their spokesman, who said, yes, you know, we intend to follow this law, but, you know, a situation could arise where we don't have to. And so that's what it means. And, you know, there was a sense of outrage over that, including among Republican senators like Lindsey Graham and John Warner, and especially John McCain. We negotiated this. This is what it means. We passed the law. You've got to follow it. And the question with both of the Patriot Act and the torture thing is, this is just a piece of paper in which he says, yeah, I don't have to do this if I don't want to. But it's not proof that he's not going to do it, and it's not proof that he hasn't done it.
Can Congress do anything about this?
Well, that's a good question. If they have the political will, they can try to pass more tougher legislation. They can try to withhold funding for things. They could launch investigations. You know, right now Congress is, however, dominated by the same party as the president. They are not particularly willing to, or have not proved themselves particularly willing until now, with a few exceptions, to be too aggressive in conducting oversight on what he's doing.
Well, Charlie Savage, I want to thank you for being with us, and we will link at democracynow.org to your stories at the Boston Globe. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back from break, we'll look at the Sudan. We'll look at the latest developments there, particularly in Darfur. We'll look at the growing student divestment movement in this country. And we'll look at an ad that was just taken out in the New York Times, an 8-page ad. The Sudanese government paid about $1 million for it. Stay with us. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we turn now to the situation in Darfur in the Sudan. On Saturday, the government of Sudan urged the United Nations to stop sending what they called negative signals to rebel groups in the country's Darfur region. While anti-Khartoum rebels have long urged UN involvement to counter what many consider state-sponsored genocide, the Sudanese government has claimed a UN presence would only worsen the conflict. Over the past 3 years, tens of thousands of people have been killed in the region, over 2 million displaced. The violence in Darfur has worsened in recent months and has now crossed into the neighboring country of Chad. While the international response has been criticized as lethargic, it was recently exposed that a man accused of being a key architect of the Darfur genocide met secretly with senior British and American officials in London just a few weeks ago. Major General Salah Abdullah Ghosh was granted a British visa to receive, quote, medical treatment. But it was later acknowledged that while in London, Ghosh met with U.S. and British officials. Meanwhile, a largely student-run divestment campaign is gaining significant momentum. The mutual fund Citizens Advisors recently became the first U.S. fund to back a growing campaign urging divestment from companies doing business in Sudan. The decision followed the University of California's decision 2 weeks ago to divest from all companies working with the Sudanese government. Joining us to discuss the situation in Sudan and the response here in the U.S. is Ian Levine, Program Director for Human Rights Watch. Joining us on the phone from San Francisco, Jason Miller, a graduate student at the University of California and co-director of the UC Sudan Divestment Task Force. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Ian, let's start with you. Can you talk about the latest in Darfur and the significance of Ghosh coming to London?
The situation on the ground remains extremely grave. War crimes and crimes against humanity are being committed daily. Attacks, killings, rapes are continuing. Major General Salah Abdullah Ghosh has been named by us and others as being one of the architects of the atrocities being committed. So the fact that he's been received in the UK and in the U.S., supposedly because he's providing extremely important intelligence on counterterrorism, is somewhat troubling. We know that his name has been recommended by a U.N. sanctions panel for targeted sanctions against him, and we very much want to see those sanctions put into place.
What is the latest in Darfur?
Well, the latest in Darfur is extremely critical. The conflict spills over into Chad. The humanitarian access is worsening. The Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs recently said that he was extremely concerned about the ability of his workers to access the millions of people now in need of humanitarian assistance. And as you said in your introduction, the Sudanese government continues to block the idea of a UN force that would provide effective protection for civilians. We currently have 7,000 African Union troops on the ground who are doing a good job, but they can't possibly, in an area the size of Texas and extremely remote and isolated, provide the kind of effective protection needed by over 2 million displaced people.
Let's turn to one of the students who has led the divestment campaign in this country, Jason Miller. You were at the University of California. Talk about what you've done.
So back when I first learned about the genocide, I wanted to think about effective ways to counter the Sudanese government's actions. And on a historical review, it looked like Sudan had been largely unresponsive to political pressure regarding the Darfur situation, but history had shown that it had been responsive to economic pressure. And since I was part of a University of California system, which included 10 campuses and the largest endowment of any university system in the world at $66 billion, I was interested in knowing what our university's involvement were in the companies doing business in Sudan. And through about a year-long process, we discovered that there were indeed several companies that we were invested in that heavily contributed to government revenue and provided minimal benefit to ordinary Sudanese citizens outside of government circles. And so we engaged in what we called a targeted divestment campaign. Instead of just divesting from every company doing business in Sudan, recognizing that some companies were doing substantial good, we tried to investigate what each company was doing, understand how it contributed to both the government's ability to perpetrate genocide, but also to the general infrastructure development in the country, and then divest from only those companies that we felt were most contributing to the genocide.
Jason Miller, can you talk about other universities in the country that are involved in different stages of students pushing their universities not to do business with companies in Sudan?
I think the exciting part about this divestment movement is it's actually, as you've implied, has gained true national momentum. In fact, it's probably arguably now the largest divestment movement since the South Africa divestment movement. And it encompasses dozens of universities, several of which have already divested, including Harvard, Stanford, Yale, Brown, Dartmouth, Amherst, but also multiple more that are interested in divesting. And this also extends to the state level, where the states of New Jersey, Oregon, and Illinois have already divested. Maine is extremely close, and there are many other states that are considering or have divestment legislation pending at the current moment.
Jason Miller with the University of California, which is the first university to divest from companies doing business in the Sudan. Well, there's at least one company that apparently has not joined the Sudan divestment campaign. Last week, the New York Times ran an 8-page advertisement taken out by the Sudanese government. The ad advocates investing in companies operating in Sudan. It appears as a news article with a small disclaimer across the top of the page. The ad praises Sudan's, quote, peaceful, prosperous, and democratic future and complains about international media coverage that is, quote, focused almost exclusively on the fighting between rebels and Arab militias in Darfur. In response, Sudan activists flooded the New York Times with demands for an apology. They've so far refused. The New York Times also declined to appear on Democracy Now! But did give us this statement. Quote, "The Times has vigorously reported on the Sudan, and our editorials have condemned the actions the Sudanese government has taken against its citizens. We accepted this special advertising section. However, in our strong belief that all pages of the paper's news, editorial, and advertising must remain open to the free flow of ideas, in accepting it, we do not endorse the politics, trade practices, or actions of the country or the character of its leaders, just as we print advertisements that rebut New York Times editorials, news articles, or critical reviews. We print ads that differ from our editorial position. We do so in the belief that it's in the best interest of our readers for our pages to be as open as possible." That statement was given to us by the New York Times. Well, the advertisement, which is really a special ad supplement of the New York Times, cost close to $1 million. It was produced by the PR company Summit Communications. Summit claims to hold a, quote, exclusive agreement with the Times, where it has run ads for several foreign governments. We're joined on the line by Felix Salmon. He is a writer and media critic who has covered the relationship between the New York Times and Summit Communications on his weblog at felixsalmon.com, speaking to us from New Mexico. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Felix.
Thank you.
Well, can you explain how this works? I mean, the supplement, and we've seen it before, is an 8-page, looks like a section of the Times. At the top, though, it says in small letters, special advertising supplement, big words, Sudan, and then it says the peace dividend. Prosperity could lie ahead after years of conflict. And it looks like an article.
Yes, that's the idea that while obviously media sophisticates in New York are well aware that this is an advertisement, there is confusion among a certain proportion of the New York Times readers as to whether or not they don't really stop to think whether it is an ad or not.
Explain then what happens. Summit Communications has on its website, it has an exclusive relationship with the New York Times.
Summit Communications is essentially parasitical on the New York Times. As far as I can make out, their only business is placing advertising in the New York Times. This is a business which many publications around the world do in-house. They go out to foreign governments or other entities and produce advertising sections to be inserted into the publication. That those advertising sections are not produced by the editorial side of the publication, but they are produced by the advertising side of the publication. The New York Times, were it to do that, would thereby be dealing directly with the government of Sudan and taking the government of Sudan's money, and that would look a bit nasty. So what they've managed to do is place themselves at one remove by accepting money instead from Summit Communications.
Ian Levine of Human Rights Watch, this section, the supplement, came out last Monday in the Times. How did you see it?
I found it deeply, deeply shocking that the Times has been one of the few media outlets in this country which has done a good job in covering Sudan and Darfur and has pointed out what's going on. For them to take nearly $1 million from money, much of which obtained through violations of human rights, since the oil work in Sudan has involved forced displacement of civilians, massive killings, seems extremely troubling. This really is blood money, and it's surprising that the Times chose to take it.
I wanted to read from the content guidelines of the New York Times for ads, what they'll take and what they won't take, just a few of the guidelines. Number one, general advertisements that contain fraudulent, deceptive, or misleading statements or illustrations, attacks of a personal nature, advertisements that are overly competitive or that refer abusively to the goods or services of others. Two, offensive to good taste, indecent, vulgar, suggestive, or other advertising that, in the opinion of the New York Times on the web, may be offensive to good taste. And then it goes on from there. Refers, for example, guideline eight, endangered species advertisements offering furs or products made from the furs or hides of animals included on government endangered species lists.
It's extraordinary that the Times is concerned about endangered animal species, but seems to show much less concern for endangered human beings. So much of the money that the Sudanese government is making from the oil industry is being channeled into the military budget. Back in 2001, it was something like 60%. So to be concerned about animals and not to be concerned about the impact of oil revenue on the people of Darfur seems to be a somewhat misplaced concern there.
How many letters do you understand have gone to the Times, or do you know?
I know that last week the Save Darfur Coalition, which really mobilized its supporters on this, mobilized something like 2,600 letters in the space of 24 hours. I had a chance to see some of them, and they were very powerful, very moving, many of them, not written by kind of professional human rights activists, but by people who just care about what's going on. So it's interesting that the Times has still not chosen to reply properly.
You saw them by reading in the Times?
No, the sorry. I saw from the Save Darfur Coalition.
Did they appear in the New York Times?
No. To my knowledge, I have not seen one yet in the New York Times. And the only response I've seen from the Times is, in fact, the one that that you read out earlier.
I'm looking at a piece in something called Pacific Magazine. That's a kind of tourism magazine. And I wanted to ask you about this, Felix Salmon. It says, PNG, New York Times to expose PNG abroad. The Morobe province of Papua New Guinea will be featured prominently in the New York Times magazine this year, The National Reports. Two reporters, Ada Vellon and Luke Hine from Summit Communications, told the Morobe governor yesterday that it would give PNG the opportunity to improve its image, which has been tarnished abroad. Summit Communications is a multimedia organization linked to the New York Times. And it goes on from there. What are they talking about when they say reporters?
They're talking about people who write the copy for Summit Communications. They are certainly not talking about reporters for the New York Times, but frankly, it's in Summit Communications' best interest to confuse that distinction when they're trying to sell ads to people like the government of Papua New Guinea.
Now, is that the Times' responsibility?
Summit Communications could not exist without the New York Times. So the Times works extremely closely with Summit Communications, or at least it should, in order to ensure that what Summit Communications does not bring the New York Times into any kind of disrepute. On the other hand, the Times does get many millions of dollars from Summit Communications and is therefore financially interested in Summit selling as many of these supplements as it can.
Now, you, Felix Salmon, work for a publication called Euromoney?
Yes, I do.
How does that operate? And does it have similar supplements that are paid for by, well, governments like the Sudan?
have supplements which are paid for by governments, I'm pretty sure that Sudan is not one of them.
And does it work in the same way?
It does. Most of its supplements come against editorial. So if there's going to be a supplement on a country, the advertising is going to appear against independent editorial about that country.
In the same issue?
Yes.
So they look at the ad and they respond to it in the magazine.
There's independent journalism about the country, and then there is also the advertising about the country, and they appear together.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how you feel the New York Times is different?
The New York Times is different because it does not feel any need to match editorial content against advertising, which in many ways is a good thing, but because it means the editorial content is dictated entirely by the views of the editors about what is newsworthy and not so much by the content of the advertising. On the other hand, that means that if you get these supplements about countries like Sudan or Libya or whoever, then they appear on their own without any enveloping context explaining that this is really just government propaganda and that there is another side to the story.
Now, presumably, these ads are approved by the Times in an editorial division, whether it's in the publisher's office somewhere, because they do make decisions. The Times rejected a religious ad saying many readers would find it offensive in 2002 and 2004. The Times rejected an artistic commentary on race and gender by citing a policy that all advocacy ads must clearly state an opinion. Just this month, the Times rejected a theater advertisement for its depiction of two Cupids engaging in a sex act. Ian Levine of Human Rights Watch, do you think the Times should refuse to take money from the Sudanese government? I mean, specifically, it's probably Sudanese government pays Summit Communications, who then pays the Times, though I'm not sure how it works.
I'm assuming that is the case. If the Times feels that two Cupids engaging in a sex act is offensive to its readers, I think it should be really much more careful about taking money from a government which many have accused of genocide, others have accused of war crimes and crimes against humanity. It's extremely offensive to the people of Sudan, to human rights activists anywhere. They are providing a propaganda space for the government of Sudan. And it's a very important propaganda space. This is not any paper. This is the New York Times. And for the New York Times to be providing such a platform for the government is deeply offensive.
And their argument that might be that you look at reporters like Nicholas Kristof, who writes very harshly of what's going on in Sudan.
Well, Nick Kristof has done great work, and all credit to Nick. He's pushed and pushed and pushed on Darfur and on Chad, and he's really helped to keep the flame alive for those who've been working on this issue. But to cite Nick as a justification for running eight pages of very questionable propaganda with a lot of falsehoods, I don't think that makes up for the fact that they're putting out this supplement and it's wrong.
Well, I want to thank you, Ian Levine, for joining us from Human Rights Watch. Felix Salmon, FelixSalmon.com is his blog, and Jason Miller at the University of California. They're not the first university to cut off dealings with companies doing business with the Sudan, was one of the largest, and it just happened. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shreve Dokadoos, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate. Also special thanks to Megan Whitney and Danielle Stramberg-Peshkin. Our website is democracynow.org. Nick Massilio, and I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.